Good afternoon, and welcome to the Vizient Southeast Educational Webinar on Identifying Critical Steps in Preparation for Value-Based Care, hosted by Dr. George Mazel and Moses Plancher of Vizient Southeast, and special guest speaker Sherry Morgan. At this time, I will turn the webinar over to Dr. George Mazel. George?
Good. Thanks, Debbie, and welcome, everybody. It's been a little while since we've had a webinar. I think this is going to be a good one for everybody. I'm going to do a very, very brief introduction, and then we will jump right in because we have a lot of material, and in fact, there's a lot of slides that you can look at. I don't know that we're going to have time to cover all of them. First of all, high level, this is really directed at helping everybody move toward value-based healthcare. It includes, physician engagement pieces, alignment pieces, and integration pieces. This transition, we recognize that everybody's still very much in a fee-for-service environment, and what we want to do is set up the stage so that you can do things in the fee-for-service environment that will be profitable, both in terms of cost, quality, and patient experience, but also lay the groundwork for folks to move toward new different payment models and value-based healthcare as they show themselves. So we want folks starting to think outside the four walls of a hospital, thinking about the connectivity between the physicians and the hospital, and really thinking about value-based care without losing sight of the critical issue right now, which is continuing with one foot in each canoe while you're working on fee-for-service and value-based care. So things such as looking at quality, looking at data and how to handle it, and that infamous term called leakage, or as I like to call it, keepage, which is keeping your patients inside the system. So with that, I want to do a little, just a little bit of advertisement here on something we're doing here at Vizient Southeast, and that we're going to be really focusing on physician alignment, and in particular as it relates to things such as a clinically integrated network. So while this webinar is not in any way, shape, or means specifically about clinically integrated network, the concept is very amenable to that, and we're going to be doing a collaboration with all of our members looking at different opportunities and data and information on how best to align physicians, and in particular with a clinically integrated network. So you'll see some emails coming out. This is just sort of a little heads up. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about Sherry. I'm sure it will be self-explanatory. I've known Sherry for many years. She's been in healthcare for, we'll say, at least 20 years, not to be too specific. And she's done a lot of different things, the administrative and leadership area. Where I met her was working on a project really focused on clinical variation and really leading that project and achieving some great measurable goals in that area. So she spent many years at different consulting organizations, most recently Navigant, now she's really helping members and people move toward this new value-based care. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Sherry.
Thank you, George. I think I'm supposed to be switching this over to my my slides now. So let me just get this to the clean screen.
Yep.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you, George. It's always a pleasure. I've worked with George for several years, and I always love working with George. He and I think together and come up with solutions, and so I've always really enjoyed working with him. So good afternoon. So glad to spend this virtual time with you. It's probably the first time I've ever done a webinar with this many people. I'm used to looking at the crowd and walking the crowd, but getting used to here. So you know what my face looks like. Now you know what my voice looks like. I just wish I could see you. As we begin today, we do have quite a few slides. I promise that you all can send these slides out after the presentation, and I have some notes in here that hopefully will help validate and clarify some things if you don't remember all that I say today, which I'm sure you won't. But I'll start off with, I know you all are familiar with what conversations are going on in the marketplace. but I want to continue those conversations today. And I'll begin with really the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid because they seem to kind of set the stage, don't they? The Centers, CMS, and Accountable Care Organization efforts are really gaining a lot of attention. And the commercial payers are spending billions of dollars converting to risk-based contracts. But any industry that's responsible for nearly 20% of the nation's gross domestic product, we know it's going to take some time to transform. We've been talking about this. I can tell George it's been about 30 years. He was the most kind there. Most of us believe it's going to be a long journey. I've watched this journey for a long time. And the good news is we do continue to move. The bad news is it's not fast enough for me. But the journey is going to be different for each and every organization, and I'm sure you all recognize that. The local markets, the regional biases, any federal and state regs, as well as your own institutional structure, and most importantly, your corporate cultures will all contribute to the uniqueness of every provider's situation. While some organizations need to really put their financial houses in order, others have really optimized their financial performance to the point where efficiencies are more difficult to draw out. And for some, I would say success may require providers to take action that reduces fee-for-service payments with the potential to undermine financial stability. Waiting too long for some of these to make these necessary investments, however, does expose the organization to the same risk. The next stage in the journey, I think, from providing care to managing health, is really putting a plan in place, a roadmap, I'd say, for transitioning from volume to value. As organizations move to value-based care, the risk dynamics change from an operational to a population focus. You all have heard the buzzwords about population health. We're probably sick of them, all of us together. But bearing population risk means concentrating on the value of care delivered to a defined population. And it really requires innovative and transformational care delivery models to manage different risk segments. Timing for this is really everything, and it'll vary in each market. I'm hoping that today, the objectives that I've outlined, that we will focus on what I believe from listening to George and some of your team, what you're experiencing in your market today. Here's the objectives that I've outlined. They're pretty stiff. There's a lot here, a lot of slides, but they do cover the slides that I have put together for you. I'd first like to explore some considerations for evaluating how and when to change payer contracting strategies and underlying operational platforms. The key to this is understanding the forces that drive value-based transition. I'd like to help you understand your organization's current state and the strategic intent position with regard to value-based models of care and your market maturity. I'd like to help you identify potential initiatives you should or might focus on to prepare your organization for value-based care that match your current market maturity and your current strategic intent. And this is all based upon much of what's going on in your organization as well as the culture and your willingness to take on risk. I'd like to help you evaluate the investment required to reach your strategic intent. We're just going to look at one slide that kind of gives you an idea of if you're here and you want to go here, what's the investment look like. I'd like to help you explore strategic themes for consideration for value-based care positioning. Identify some key components for creating a clinical strategy and model for a clinical integration network. This is the one we're going to really zero in on today because I think it'll be the most useful for you based upon listening to some of the things that George has got planned for you going forward. And last but not least, as part of this second to last, we're going to explore 10 specific protect and defend strategies. And you'll know what I mean by that in just a few minutes. Decisions on when and how to change payer contracting strategies and underlying operational platforms, I think, must be informed by four key considerations. And maybe there's six, but I outlined four here. And I think they're pretty simple. The first is the government policy drivers, CMS, Medicare and Medicaid. The second is the local and regional market drivers, the third, the organization's current position profile with regard to value-based care, so your value-based transition, so your current state, and the fourth is the organization's strategic intent for adoption. What are you willing to take on for new care models? When we need to continually keep our eyes on these four things, I think. Together, these considerations provide really a framework for making key decisions regarding the speed of transition from fee-for-service to value-based reimbursement in a manner that's on pace with the local market. I ask you today to consider, how and when do you change payer contracting strategies, and when and how do we change our operating platforms? When you consider the two together, it helps you to align these contracting strategies in a way that's fruitful. Just to summarize some of the things that we cannot change but must understand and be prepared for, I've outlined here for you things I don't think I need to really read to you. It's what's required from CMS how they really set the floor and kind of the progress that they've made since they said they were going to be moving towards value-based care. What we're faced with coming up here is that there's an expected growth up to 90% by 2018 of traditional Medicare payments moving to metric-based programs. In other words, the Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program and the Physician Value-Based Modifier Program. In compliance to this MACRA and MIPS, or Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, really is really something that we just all have to do. From a state perspective, there's less downside on transitioning away from fee-for-service, given lower reimbursement rates, but there's also a potential upside in minimizing the use of high-cost services, which providers often furnish to this population at a loss. And we're really seeing this in all the markets. And so I ask you today, you know, are you prepared for these projected impacts? And the questions you need to ask yourself are, some of the things we're going to be going through in the next couple slides. The five key market drivers that I want to talk about are population size density, market cost use rates, commercial payer activity, employers, and competitors. And just very, very briefly, and I've actually included these in notes in this presentation so that you can have them later, but I want to cover these just very, very quickly. While the federal and state initiatives provide a consistent floor for transition, there really is a significant variation at the local market level, and I'm sure you all are aware of that. To manage the pace of change consistent with the local market, it's really important to understand the forces that drive value-based care in transition at this level and to track them over time. So I'm going to give you some ideas of some areas where you can begin to measure, and maybe you already are, so I'm making assumptions here. But I think it's important to measure these over time. Since the population size and density for a particular market do not change rapidly, the key metrics here are relative to activities and lean indicator markets. So these markets may be larger markets in the state or region. For example, Miami, Orlando, and Tampa may be lean indicators for Gainesville and Tallahassee, just as an example. For larger markets, the lean indicators would be national and value-based contracting initiatives of leading national payers. If you're going for market costs and use rates, they are sensitive to regional changes. So if you're going to measure that, you should consider how use rates and costs for a particular market compare to national, state, and regional MSA by looking at things like Dartmouth Atlas data for Medicare comparisons, commercial cost per capita for claims databases, hospital charge comparison data, media coverage, hospital rates, and so forth. For the commercial payer activity metrics, I think you should consider things like enrollment market share trends for commercial and Medicare Advantage plans, local impact of national insurer mergers, launches of new alternative-based programs, and private health exchanges. For the employer drivers, things to measure would be number of locally based self-insured employers, arrangements with providers, example provider direct contracting, occupational health initiatives, on-site primary care delivery, and activity of local, regional, and state employers. When it comes to your competitors, you might want to consider attributed lives estimates for commercial and Medicare Advantage plans, clinical integrated network and ACO network size, i.e. the number of providers, especially PCPs, participation in Medicare alternative payment models, like your ACO or bundled payments, participation in commercial alternative payment models, and mergers, acquisitions, and affiliations. And there's others, but these are just a few to list. Once the external drivers are clear, it's important to understand the organization's current state or current position or profile with regard to value-based care models. No matter really where you are in your market maturity, you need to consider your current position with regard to these 5 points that I've listed here. So I would suggest that, you know, no matter what your current position with regard to evolving value-based contract structures, are you currently embracing things like global risk contracts, shared savings, or pursuing clinical integration? From listening to what George just said, it sounds like you're planning to pursue clinical integration in, over the next year or so. You also need to look at, you know, what are our current acute care and outpatient capabilities? What are our post-acute strategies and affiliation agreements, and where do we need to build strength there? And then, you know, last but not least, physician structures that really position you for value-based care. Many organizations don't even have really good structures within the hospital walls for acute care, for medical staff leadership. And many are trying to move towards ACO and SIN without these foundational structures. So these are things to think about. When you consider your organizational profile with regard to these five areas that I just covered, you have to consider how do you evaluate your current capabilities. Now, I've listed 3 points here that I think are helpful. When I sit down at the table and I help organizations think through how to assess their current organizational profile, I always ask them to discuss, have discussions with very broad stakeholder involvement, including critics as well as champions. So don't just invite all the people that you think are, you know, the ones that are going to side with what your perspective is. The assessment should really be honest and reflect how the organization really behaves rather than how it would like to think of itself or the image it would like to project. You know, we all want to invite the people to the party we want to hear from. But you need for this to be meaningful. So the assessment must include a reflection on what has influenced the organization to be in this position at the current time. Is it strictly a reflection of external factors? Are you just doing this because somebody says you have to? Or does it reflect a risk-averse culture? Were there historical experiences that you are still holding on to that influence your perspective? Maybe you had a bad experience with a risk-based contracting from the past, and you have a CFO that's nervous about entering into another one. So those are some things to think about. In this slide here, I want to cover what I call some operational definitions about how you can decide what is our current state. It helps to give you a feel for your market maturity. So I call an organization that is in a current state of watchful waiting, they're still not convinced that the transition to value-based models will last long-term, and they'd rather react to changes as necessary versus being proactive. If you're dipping your toe in, you recognize the need to change, but you're not really willing to risk current fee-for-service reimbursement. You're really trying to hold on to it. So things like making sure that you can advertise and get everybody to come to your ED, whether it's appropriate or not, might be someone who is in this current state. Moderate development to play in the field. If you're in this current state, you're trying to figure out how do we balance fee-for-service and value-based reimbursement. You're experiencing significant tension associated with this transition. You don't want to let go of your per diem, and I don't blame you. But you need to be positioning yourself for the risk-based contracts. Well-developed infrastructure for population health management, including one or more ACO contracts. If you're a market leader positioned for strategic arrangements, then you have transitioned to an operating framework in coordination with key stakeholders built around triple aim objectives. I have not met one of these organizations yet. I've met some that aspire to be and then are working hard to get there, but I have not found one yet. So we're in the next, not this slide, but the very next slide, we're gonna look at what is your strategic intent. And once we understand the status of the local market and the current position of the health system, the next set of questions revolves around what you're willing to take on as far as risk, as far as your strategic intent with regard to value-based models. I call this slide the operational definition slide for determining what your comfort zone is as far as reactive versus proactive and your ability to be strategically focused. Again, protect and defend current reimbursement strategy is one where you're convinced that fee-for-service reimbursement will endure as the prevailing payment model in the local market, at least for the foreseeable future. These organizations really double down on traditional fee-for-service strategies, regardless of what the competitors are doing. And they really are not embarking on much change. And there's, in many cases, depending upon your market, that's not a bad thing. In fact, if you can hold on to your fee-for-service environment and you have a lot of patients coming in the door, it's a wise one to hold on to. At the same time, I'm going to show you today some of the key things you can do to help you get a larger bottom line with that fee-for-service reimbursement, as well as prepare yourself for the future with clinical integration strategies. If you're in a play catch-up to the market strategic intent, you are recognizing that you are lagging behind regional competitors or payer-employer demand, and you want to ramp up value-based capabilities to establish competitive parity. This intent implies some urgency in the pace of change, a little more than the protect and defend. If you are steadily advancing within the market, and I have seen organizations in this situation, you prefer to pace your value-based development activities consistent with the market, willing to take moderate risks. You don't want investments to far exceed returns, but you're not worried about losing a little bit too if you have to. You can leave some money on the table. The market innovators then are convinced that a full transition to population health-based care is inevitable, and they're moving headstrong and fast ahead. This slide is the one slide I just want to give you as a visual, and that's really all it is, to how much investment is needed given your understanding of your current state and the strategic intent profile of protect, defend, playing catch up, steadily advance, or market innovator. I think it gives you some perspective of the investment you may need to make based upon the degree of change required. In the appendix, I have outlined in detail many of the priorities. I'm not going to cover them all today, but many of the priorities you could choose to work on depending upon your current state and your strategic intent. In the rest of the slides today, I'm going to focus you on how to build the core foundational capabilities that are necessary in all maturity strategies, while focusing specifically on priorities for the protect and defend and the play catch-up strategies, because I think this will be the most useful given your current market needs. But you can see here that if you are in a watchful waiting and you want to move to a play catch-up, you probably have a high level of investment to make. And dipping your toe in, if you're already in protect and defend, you've probably got those things covered. But if you want to move to playing catch-up, you probably have a moderate number of initiatives to work on with that one too. And that's all I'm giving you, it's a very experienced kind of thumbs up, thumbs down, of the level of effort without going into the specifics. The appendix, I outline the different initiatives you can take on, as I said, give you a much better definition and deep dive of the types of things you would need to be working on, and that can give you a better idea of whether you're moderate or high. In this slide, I'm showing you that there are really nine that I've outlined here, nine strategic themes to consider for value-based care positioning. What I'm going to do today is look at number 7 in detail, which is create a clinical strategy and model to support clinical integration across the continuum. But you will quickly recognize that the others in green will naturally be addressed as integral to this one strategy. In other words, they really do overlap. The others in white will not be discussed today. All right, so if you do a deep dive in number 7, which is create a clinical strategy and model for clinical integration and or a clinically integrated network, there are really 6 areas that I'm going to take you through and operationally define that I think it's important for you to really understand. I'm giving you operational definitions for each one of these: clinical integration, care management, targeted interventions, patient and family education, clinical effectiveness, and IT systems and value analytics, specifically because the language in the market can be very, very confusing as terms are used interchangeably. And I just want to make sure that we are on the same page as I take you through this, and it's a meaningful presentation for you. So the way I define clinical integration based upon my experience in working in the markets with different organizations is clinical integration is really the ability to build clinical engagement across sites of care and across providers, building consensus and collaboration and shared evidence-based leading practice care guidelines that enable the improvement of quality, reduction of risk, improved patient experience, and cost-effective practice. Multiple core capabilities are required in order to optimize care delivery and reduce variation. Clinical governance is critical to provide oversight and ongoing accountability for established standardized approaches. Physician leadership and engagement are imperative to align medical staff in the consistent treatment of specific patient conditions. Infrastructure and systems are needed to facilitate and capture ongoing measurement of adherence to standardized delivery of care. Complexities of the healthcare system combined with the imperative to continually adapt to changes in payment and leading clinical practice guidelines require organizations to embark upon a multifaceted journey to transform the delivery of care. Clinical integration capabilities support the balance of these initiatives. In this slide, care management is the ability to coordinate care across the continuum to deliver an efficient and cost-effective delivery model and organize health care activities, example, scheduling appointments, arranging post-acute care, and facilitate smooth transitions across care settings. Care coordination or care management reduces fragmentation. It allows the organization to improve the patient member experience, enhances access, and ensures the execution of care plans. When you have a coordinated information and workflow, it ensures information and user actions are orchestrated in an automated, coordinated, and streamlined fashion. This is a lot of work to do. There's a lot involved in making this happen. But it's imperative. This is really a very foundational process that becomes a large system across building a continuum, but it's critical. Patient and family education, what I'm speaking about here, is really the ability to engage patients in care decisions to maintain healthy populations, improve the health of ill patients, and help patients receive the intensity of care they desire, and help patients, such as through palliative care and joint decision making. Telehealth is helping a lot with this, and many organizations are engaging in that for outreach and really building, you know, continuity of care. But just even in the inpatient setting, we often forget to involve the patient and the family in the care decisions. And I see organizations all the time with great opportunities to improve in this area. targeted inventions means the ability to design and implement evidence-based specialized care programs and interventions that cost-effectively support the health and positive outcomes of targeted patient populations. In other words, focus on patients with chronic diseases or patients with psychosocial concerns. Targeted interventions, being very proactive, allows organizations to address the full range of care, from wellness and preventative health to intensive case disease management for complex patient populations in order to improve and stabilize health status. And this helps you reduce the need for extensive medical interventions and reduces cost. If you're going to be managing populations, you want to be able to do targeted interventions very, very well. A population health management program strives to address health needs at all points along the continuum of health and well-being through participation of engagement with targeted interventions for these populations. Goals include things like maintenance or improvement of the physical and psychosocial well-being of individuals through cost-effective and tailored health solutions. Clinical effectiveness is the ability to create a robust clinical infrastructure able to identify, prioritize, and implement performance improvement initiatives across the enterprise. It includes reduction of per capita cost of care, improvement of care experience, and quality of care. Clinical effectiveness attributes assure that high-quality care processes are designed and delivered efficiently across the continuum. Sounds like nirvana, but it's what we all strive to do. And you all know healthcare is very, very complex, and this can be a strong challenge, but it's necessary if you're going to build the capabilities to manage risk and if you know where your costs are being spent. IT systems and value analytics is the ability to enable clinical integration and population health through IT connectivity, data analytics, and internal external reporting. Bottom line here is measurement and reporting enable the organization and providers to identify strengths and opportunities, and most importantly, demonstrate the value that you can bring to healthcare purchasers. This information can also be critical input into the analysis of the return on investment for risk-based arrangements. I cannot tell you how many organizations I walk into and they're involved in risk-based arrangements, but they have no idea why they're losing their shirt because they can't measure what they don't know. And I would just suggest, you know, it's really to be very cautious about not being blind when you enter into some of these arrangements. This is a pretty packed slide here. Let me ask, can you all still see this? Do you just see my slides, or do you see this? Do I need to minimize?
We're able to see.
Okay, you're good. Okay. All right.
We're able to see the slides only.
Okay, good. That was my question. All right. This slide is pretty busy, but it's very powerful. Let me tell you what this slide is about. So I just went through 6 operational definitions for how to build really a very strong foundation for clinical integration. What I have done several times is I've come in and done an assessment for clinical integration. And I have asked within these assessments very specific questions around those 6 categories that we just covered. Out of that assessment, I can, along with just interviews and talking to execs and stuff, I can get a really good feel for not only your current state and your strategic intent, as I just described to you, but I also can get, and you can too, a really good view into as you evaluate your clinical integration capability evolution, where are you in that evolutionary process? Are you just beginning to evaluate, potential strategies for clinical integration? Again, if you're in that protect and defend area or strategy, you're holding on to traditional fee-for-service. You probably have inconsistent EMR business platforms. You have limited retrospective data, focused patient interactions, and remote health plan care management. You're not really involved with health plans and integrating your care management. Those are some examples. And this assessment really helps you identify what needs to be focused on as you prepare to enter into bundled payments, shared savings programs, or center ACO strategies. It also shows expected characteristics of organizations on their maturity scale. And as a visual, I've used time and again to illustrate maturity after conducting these assessments. It's very, very helpful. And I think if you look at this slide, you know, at a later time and really look through the points here, we don't have time to go through all of them, in conjunction with what I just shared with you around your current state operational definitions, your strategic tent, and then if you go to the appendix and you look at what are some of those efforts and priorities we should be focusing on given our current maturity and what, you know, where we want to play in the market, I think it'll give you a really good view into where you are today and what you're willing to embrace over the next several years. At least that's my hope. This one is not showing up for some reason, all of my arrows, so I'll just speak to it. I'm not sure why. Looks like it's missing some things, quite a bit. This slide, I'll check the one that we send to you all again. The one I sent did have it, but this slide it speaks to this. When we speak about aligning your contracting strategies with your clinical effectiveness strategies, we need to understand which populations and program initiatives need to be worked on first to be prudent and align the resources available. When you have alignment of contracting and clinical effectiveness strategies, you have alignment for populations, programs, and resource incentives, and this positions you for achieving triple aim objectives. In other words, what I'm saying is if you understand your current state, your strategic intent, and what your organization is capable of delivering, you can line up what is our contracting strategy we're willing to enter into, and how do we know how successful we're going to be, because we can truly understand and evaluate how effective we're going to be within our clinical delivery. Oh, there you go. Now, there it is. So you can see, creates aligned incentives and payment models for providers, provide potential economic benefit to all physicians and so forth. I'm not going to read this to you. The goal here is that you line up your contracting strategy with your clinical effectiveness strategy. And I think some of the tools that I've given you so far will help you do that. I want to watch time because I want to make sure we get through. This slide is the one I want to get to, and then I want to take you through multiple examples for each of these strategies. This is a list of 10 protect and defend strategies. And this is a term George mentioned. I thought it was good. When defense wins championships. And this is really the truth. All of these strategies here, these 10, and this is not the exhaustive list. These are just 10 good ones. Will help build the foundation for a strong framework of clinical integration in support of value-based care. But most importantly, they'll help you improve clinical care and capture the most for your bottom line by the way of cost reductions for the right reasons. It really helps you to improve upon your core business. And I'm going to walk you through as many of these strategies as our time allows today. The first one is, and I've got two slides on this, you need to begin by providing senior executives and physician leadership with education on why and how to reduce the cost of care, clinical costs of care. This is a visual that I've used to point out what will happen to our bottom line if we do nothing versus if we agree to pursue some strategic initiatives and focus on operational excellence. Strategic initiatives might include things like growth or positioning strategies, like building the FIN might be one, or operational excellence, which are going to be many of the things I share with you today in these other 10 strategies. So this is a visual that I usually start with. I work with finance, and we present this to the senior executives and the medical staff, and we just really, it's the case for change. It's, you know, why are we here and why do we need to change what we're doing today? This is a different kind of a communication slide. It's a graphic that I've used to communicate to senior executives and physicians at a steering committee the types of projects being worked on and where they fit in the redesign of a care continuum to support a successful clinical integration strategy. This is really an example of a multi-project consulting job where we had, you know, 15 different things going on, but it shows how the 15 different things helped us move forward in working on things like clinical governance structure, continuum care management, care redesign, and technology enablement. And then you can also see where on the continuum does that help us to optimize from a wellness, acute hospital, post-acute, all the way through end of life. Most of these are within the acute hospital because this was an organization that was in the protect and defend moving forward and still had a lot of opportunities to reduce costs to help their bottom line in a fee-for-service environment. The second strategy for protect and defend that I want to bring up is the assess, design, and implement a very proactive inpatient care management model, reducing inpatient stay costs. And I'm going to need to move quickly because I see we have about 17 minutes here. I always tell my clients to begin with a solid inpatient acute care model for effective and proactive care management, and then build out from there across the continuum. This is because there are most often so many opportunities for reducing inpatient costs, which will better position your organization no matter what the current strategy or present strategic intent. But even most critical to value-based care position, if you can't manage the acute costs well, you won't be able to manage patient populations or risk. So this is really a foundational area to work for extending the appendages of care to outpatient providers and health plans. And this slide in particular shows the differences in the roles and responsibilities of the care managers and the social workers and how they should really be working together. This is an example of a project where I was implementing this kind of a work. I was working with two different hospitals. They were a system in the Midwest. And just by reducing their length of stay by 0.3 days, we projected a 12-month opportunity of $7.5 million. And they were close to realizing that when I left last year. So, I mean, I've done this many times. It works really well. The key here is building a clinical team that works together and proactively going after doing the things that make a difference. This next slide I'm not going to spend time on, but these are really the key advantages of an integrated care management model versus care managers trying to work on their own, a lack of a very strong physician advisor program, social workers and care managers and RNs on the floor not knowing how to integrate the roles and really support each other. But when you do, you get all these advantages to go with it. The next one I want to talk about is number three, building a leading practice physician advisor program. This is not often talked about. It doesn't sound like it's sexy and savvy in the literature, but I find almost everywhere I go that there are huge opportunities in beefing up a physician advisor program in every organization I walk into. And the reason I say that is this really is critical to a successful care management process. You have to have a proactive physician advisor program. And what I've listed here for you are really what I would call a comprehensive list of leading practices that physician advisors should be involved in. For years, they've been involved in admission decisions, observation statusing, denials, and some utilization management. But they're often not involved in discharge planning. They're often not involved with helping care management and the clinical staff and other physicians, even with the role or the management of complex patients, of early identification of post-hospital needs and resources. They most often are not involved in clinical documentation improvement, and the value is amazing when they are. They most often are not involved in consultation and counseling on the plan of care, working with docs, the attendings, and teaching and educating them in quality and tracking and trending and risk management, and the list goes on. And when you do involve them in this and you build a model where they are, The return on the investment is amazing. I would say the return on investment, very conservatively, is a 6-to-1 to 8-to-1 in that you get what you pay for. And I've worked with organizations to help build this out. We'll roll out integrated proactive care management models with care progression rounds, brought the physician advisors involved in that, along with the attendings and the hospitalists. And it's a way to really help support and reduce the cost of care. This is just a slide, and I'm going to skip through this, but you have it for the future to look at. When you're selecting the ideal physician advisor, there are some key things you want to make sure you take into consideration, and I've listed them out here. It's very, very important, and most organizations do not take these into consideration. Something else I want to point out is the selection process should have significant involvement by the care managers and the CDI staff and not just be left solely up to senior management or physician leadership, because they're the ones that really know who are the good docs that are going to be a good physician advisor as far as that role and responsibility. This is a slide that I want to point out that addresses the fourth strategy, developing an infrastructure for effective clinical governance. There's a lot on this slide, but the key thing I want to point out here is this. At the foundation of healthcare is really the necessity to assure that care delivered to patients is the highest level of clinical quality. This definition of clinical quality assures that the right care is delivered with evidence-based lean practices and done so efficiently and safely in the right setting. In other words, at the appropriate level of care. A good clinical governance infrastructure will assure that that happens. It brings physicians together. And it gets them using leading practice guidelines. It provides direction and medical staff leadership in that arena and really builds a process that addresses many of the things we've already talked about, clinical effectiveness, clinical risk management, clinical practice, patient experience, and professional development, management, and training of docs and all the clinicians. So this is a very, very important area, and most often when I walk into organizations, even if I come in after other consulting firms, they're off doing many, many projects, but they've totally skipped, because they're afraid to go there, building an effective clinical governance structure, and it will make or break any of the successes or failures that you have. This next slide is just one example, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it's a place to begin. When I talk about clinical governance, what I'm talking about is wherever you are in your journey, you need to build an infrastructure of leadership that will help you achieve your objectives. So, you know, once you get through some of this evolution from a clinical integration perspective, you know, you're going to start off with something like this, which, you know, really outlines, you're looking at clinical conditions, you've got senior leadership on a steering committee with these specific roles and responsibilities. You've got the next level down, which is, you know, the leaders working on the projects. And then you've got the people in the trenches that are really helping develop the detailed design and so forth. This is a clinical governance structural for project work to kick off your evolution. Once you mature, you're going to move away from this. This kind of a structure will be more obsolete. And you will have taken your medical staff leadership structures to a whole different level. And that's another conversation. But these are two examples of how you can begin. And these help and support organizations' efforts in moving towards value-based care very, very, very successfully. This slide is a slide that illustrates the fifth strategy that I outlined for you, which is reducing costs associated with physician practice variation by focusing on high cost and volume clinical conditions. This is a slide that shows physician performance variation for DRG 870 or septicemia. When beginning acute care work, I think one of the most important areas to focus in on, and this is actually a lot of the work that I've done with George in the past, is reducing the costs associated with physician practice variation. It takes the whole clinical team, though, to do this correctly. These type of projects can then be used as a springboard to help expand to leading clinical care practices across the continuum and position you to go at risk for specific populations, if and when you decide to do so. I've been helping clients to do this work since the 90s, when the healthcare industry was just beginning to focus on the application of quality improvement principles of care. And this is really our core business. So all that we can do to help our physicians and the clinical teams take care of patients with the highest level of quality and reducing unwarranted variation that adds costs that we're not going to be paid for in the future, it is the work we should be focusing on. The next couple of slides, I'm going to skip through this one really quick because I'm just going to talk about it as I show you these slides. This slide and the next one are examples of an analysis that I often do when I come into an organization, and you very likely have done these yourself. You look at your top 25, maybe top 10, 15, 25 clinical conditions or DRGs, and you look at where you are compared to peer groups. In this example, I'm showing a client that I had compared to the 50th and 40th percentile. And this assessment looks at costs associated with the excess resources used and our unit costs, costs associated with excess days, and total saving opportunities when these two are combined. Remember this strategy because you can further stratify the clinical conditions down to those with certain populations, such as Medicare, MSSP, and or employer populations if you have an employer plan, as a first strategy for building a SIN. And I talk about this and show this in some later slides. This next slide is one that takes the next level of detail down, and it shows the breakdown of variable costs by pharmacy, lab, OR, imaging, radiology, supplies, and therapies. It highlights in particular room and board costs and supply costs. When a large opportunity is shown in the room and board category, this tells you that the greatest opportunities are really in length of stay. If the analysis illustrates that there's a large opportunity in supplies, it's often tied directly to surgical supplies such as in orthopedics. For example, we know that reducing costs in implants for orthopedic surgery is by far the biggest opportunity for variable cost reduction in these conditions. And you're probably very, very involved in this and have done this in the past, and if you haven't, I'm sure you will be. But standardizing, getting your orthopedic surgeons at the table and agreeing to go down to reducing the number of implants that they require you to have in your organization, and then also just negotiating with the suppliers to get your costs down is one way to reduce about 30% of your direct variable cost per case. That's what the supply cost, usually that range. This slide, well, let me say at this point, one of our objectives today is to look at identifying key components for creating a clinical strategy and a model for clinical integration network. I want to walk you through key initiatives some of my clients have utilized to prepare for this process. First and foremost, they determine where they want to focus on cost reduction, which is this first setup here, hospital quality efficiency, employee populations, MSSP. These are examples, okay? So the hospital quality and efficiency really addresses all those things we've talked about thus far, kind of 1 through 5. The next set, select and agree, are the 6 through 9 are very, very specific that we're going to be talking about that are very, very specific for the SIN. So first and foremost, organizations determine where they want to focus on cost reduction. Then secondly, they identify programs and priorities for where they should focus their efforts, as well as select and implement metrics so that they can illustrate their value within their contracting efforts. So the second category, select and agree upon metrics for each initiative in addition to ACO required metrics, organizations will zero in on how are we going to demonstrate through per member per month initiatives how we're improving health and wellness. How are we going to demonstrate what are some key metrics for avoidable readmission reductions, reducing hospital acquired conditions, and so forth. And I'm going to show you some of these metrics in the next several slides here in a few minutes, slides that are are required. These are metrics that there's a certain standardized way you have to address metrics if you're going to build a SIN. There are certain requirements that the government requires that you demonstrate, and I'm going to give you some examples of those. This slide relates to this. When considering your priorities about what you're going to focus on, it's really important to keep in mind what your focus for risk strategy includes. So this will really help you decide what opportunities for improvement to focus on. The meaning, you can't do it all, right? So if you're going to think about pay-for-performance programs or bundled payments or shared savings programs, there you may be working on different things. But the key is, and I think I've said this before, don't enter into risk-based arrangements blind to what it will cost you as a me-too strategy. I think I've said that. I've walked into so many organizations that are in negotiations or already have shared savings programs with Medicare, and they're losing their shirt because they weren't even able to evaluate what their costs were going to be, and they had no way of really knowing how much they could lose. And so when they entered into negotiations, it was, you know, they really went into it in a blind way. This is an example this slide represents a typical first-year approach to building SIN capabilities and includes really numbers 6 through 9 of our 10 protect and defend strategies, and then numbers 1 through 5 that I talked about in the beginning, prepare acute care and prepare you for this first year of SIN development. In other words, if you zero in on 1 through 5 and number 10, which I'm going to get to, I hope, is ED throughput, that helps you reduce your costs and helps your bottom line, which then positions you to go off and do some of these more strategic things. But I'm going to show you in the next couple of slides how you can focus your acute care efforts in areas where you might be willing to or be interested in entering into negotiations as you build out your SIN and you plan it for the first couple years. This is one example of where a couple of my clients have zeroed in on programs that had to do with reducing variable costs, specifically with working with physicians and building out strong care management programs within the acute care setting, but focusing those efforts in both the employee population, because they were an employer that was managing the risk of their employees, and the MSSP. And then along with that, where they were looking for ways to reduce cost per case, or, i.e. supply costs, length of stay, and hospital-acquired conditions, they also went after looking for ways to reduce avoidable readmissions, avoidable inpatient and EDs. In other words, you know, keeping patients out of the hospital, which may sound a little scary if you're in that protect and defend, when it's appropriate, or keeping patients out of the ED. There was a couple of my clients that realized that they had a high percentage of inappropriate ED visits, and one of their solutions was they actually opened a walk-in clinic really almost next door to their ED, so they could direct their members, in this case, to the right level of care. And this was for organizations that were entering into these preliminary contract strategies for shared savings and population health. This is an example. This slide and the next one is really a breakdown of the savings from the previous slide. So you can see with this that for avoidable inpatient and avoidable ED, for the employee population, there was a $900,000 opportunity for avoidable inpatient and a $1.6 million opportunity for the MSSP. For avoidable ED, there was a $2.6 million opportunity in the employee and a $600,000 for the MSSP. We don't have time to go through all of this, but this is a way to break down and to show where does your opportunity lie. Where are the savings opportunities for different populations that clinical leadership will focus on? And it really helps you to plan out your first, second, third, fourth, and fifth year cost reduction initiative. I've been given the heads up that we need to kind of wrap up, so I'm going to go through here very, very quickly. The next couple of slides just take you through. This is a cost per case example for an organization where we were zeroing in on those two populations, the employee and the Medicare. This is the medical DRGs for Medicare. This is surgical DRGs, and the next one here is OB DRGs. What we found when we did the cost per case analysis in the employer group, obviously they were younger, so the high cost per case clinical conditions were OB and newborn and joints, total joints. So those were the areas that we zeroed in on for improvement, and we took our acute care work to the next level. And then for their MSSP, we obviously worked on their top five DRGs that you find most common in the Medicare population. This is just an example slide that shows the difference in variable cost per case by service line for cases with and without a hospital-acquired condition. I want to mention that developing metrics for clinical integration is absolutely critical. When you give physicians information about their very specific data, they pay attention, and when you compare them to their peers, they pay even more attention. Very quickly, and these are just metrics, that, and you can read the slides, it's very clear. They're example metrics for the first-year SIN metrics for each of these areas that I've pointed out to you. And last but not least on the protect and defend strategy was really to improve emergency department throughput. And you can read through these slides, and I've given you a business case with some results that shows the money that was saved from one of my clients. But I bring this up because it's so critical. In today's world, I see so many organizations not addressing this very simple area of improvement. And even if they do, they take their eyes off it and slides right back to them having their patients on diversion. You know, their ambulances are diverting, they're not bringing patients to their ED, or they're bringing all the inappropriate patients to the ED. And what I often see is that the clients are building wings at expanding EDs when all they really need to do is focus on improving their ED throughput. And it's a great opportunity to add revenue, reduce costs, and to really just do the right thing. So with that, George, I'm going to turn it back over to you or Moses. I think we've gotten through the slides, and I thank you for today.
Great. Thanks, Sherry. Great job. We appreciate it. Great overview to what's going to be a big project for everybody, including us, moving forward. We don't have a whole bunch of time. I'll open it up if people want to type in a quick question. And what we'll do is we may take a question or two, but more likely we'll give it a minute. And then what we'll do is we'll take questions, but we'll just handle them offline so we don't keep people on the line well over the limit. If there's any quick questions, be happy to entertain them.
I do see one in the box, but okay. Just very quickly, I just want to remind everyone, if you want to ask a question, please either type the question in the question box or click on the hand icon to raise your hand. If your hand is raised, the presenter will unmute you so that you can ask the question. So the one question I do see is how best to engage docs on aligning strategies?
This is the best way. If you remember the first slide that I showed you that shows if we do nothing, this is where we're going to be. If we do something, this is what our opportunity is. That is the slide I always start with physician leadership. And I start with that along with the top five clinical condition analysis to show them where the greatest opportunity in saving variable cost per case as it relates to the physician pen. In other words, how they practice medicine. And, you know, everybody's always afraid to do this, but docs get it. They get it. George, they get it, right? And they will work with you. So the key is not pointing fingers at them, but making them your partners and letting them be the leaders. And so really, it's just bringing them into the fold. Now, building a solid care management model that supports them and then shows them how you're going to help them is key. So they usually go hand in hand. I've never done one without the other in an organization and have been successful, but involving them on the front end and really they love data. They love data and they want to see how they're improving. And if you start comparing them to their peers and making that very clear, they move the needle.
Great. Good answer. I think at this point, I'll invite folks to send questions either directly to Moses or myself, and we'll get them to Sherry and get them answered. But at that point, I'll thank everybody for giving us part of your afternoon, and thank Sherry for doing a great job and obviously putting a lot of thought and time and effort into a great slide presentation. And everybody have a good Thanksgiving if I don't talk to you before then.
Thanks, George, and thanks, team. Thanks,
Cynthia.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.